Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Wild Horse and Burro Radio, an educational outreach program of Wild Horse Freedom Federation. This year marks the 25th anniversary of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, also known as PEER. PEER defends whistleblowers, protects public health, shields scientists from interference, helps law enforcement agencies pursue violations of anti-pollution and wildlife protection laws, safeguards public lands, shelters wildlife, and works to end giveaways of your public resources. Kirsten Stade is PEER's advocacy director. Prior to coming to PEER, Kirsten worked on scientific integrity issues with a D.C. nonprofit and also campaigns targeting extractive industries on public lands with nonprofits in both New Mexico and Oregon. Kirsten has published research with Wild Earth Guardians on the impacts of livestock grazing on fire ecology and ecosystem health of the American West. She also has a master's degree in conservation biology from Columbia University and a bachelor's in earth systems from Stanford University. Welcome to the show, Kirsten.
Thanks, Debbie. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I should say welcome to the show again. We really enjoyed having you last time, and I'm so happy that you could spare some time to come back again.
Thanks so much.
Kirsten, to start off the show, can you tell us about the U.S. Bureau of Land Management employees now under orders to wear vision cards on their uniforms?
Yeah, this was a press release that we sent out recently because we heard from some of our contacts within the Bureau of Land Management, employees that we've worked with or that have been our clients, that they were under orders to wear these little vision cards, and we got some in the mail from our contact, and they're humorous if they weren't so frightening. They're like a little laminated wallet-sized card that you wear around your neck, and you know, on the front they have the nice Bureau of Land Management logo, which is has a tree and a river and a mountain, and then it goes through our vision, our mission, our values, and on the back it has our guiding principles. But what's kind of new and different about these vision cards is that on the front there's a picture of an oil rig, and on the back there's a picture of grazing cattle and ranchers. And what's also kind of interesting is these guiding principles listed are something that's a new level of brazenness in terms of the Bureau of Land Management's commitment to serving extractive industries, which is it lists a guiding principle as to pursue excellence in business practices, improve accountability to our stakeholders, and deliver better service to our customers. So it doesn't really sound like a resource management agency guiding principle to you, does it?
No, and it doesn't sound like all the American people are their customers, just the special interests.
Right, and no mention of serving the public, by the way. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, who issued the order to wear these vision cards?
So we're pretty sure it originated within the Department of the Interior headquarters here in D.C. And, of course, the Department of Interior is directed by Ryan Zinke. Right now, the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management itself, has no permanent director, and the White House under Trump hasn't even named a nominee. But, you know, according to some reporting that's come out on these vision cards after our press release went out, last year, the acting director at the time, his name was Mike Ned, commissioned artwork that would highlight oil and natural gas drilling, mining, and grazing on public lands. And this was reported to the Washington Post by an interior official who spoke on condition of anonymity out of fear of retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
So we're pretty sure that this artwork commissioned was what ended up on these vision cards. Yeah, and so, you know, the BLM has confirmed when they've been contacted by the press that, oh, no, wearing these vision cards is voluntary. But we've heard from employees who say pretty much they've been ordered to wear them, or at least that they've been strongly pressured to wear them. And a few have said that they absolutely, that's not going to happen. I mean, they're not going to wear these things in a million years. So, yeah.
So what's the opinion of Peer regarding these vision cards?
You know, we've seen some examples of this throughout this administration, but it really, this is a blatant example of using federal employees as vehicles for propaganda distribution. And, you know, this is supposed to be the Bureau of Land Management, not Mao's Red Guard, right? But we see this again and again in this administration. You know, in the EPA, Administrator Scott Pruitt has done something really similar where he's hung posters in the hallways of the building that say things like, certainty for the American economy is one of EPA's great environmental achievements, which is an interesting way to brand, to talk about environmental achievements, but it's just another example of, you know, rebranding these agencies and really sort of pushing their agenda as being in favor of business interests and extractive industries.
Yeah, and I think what's so frightening about this is that these propaganda placards basically are used by totalitarian regimes. You know, I these are our public lands, and we want our resources for the American people, and that's who they should be serving.
Absolutely.
What's Peer notice that's been happening at the Department of the Interior with Ryan Zinke as the secretary?
So, you know, we hear a lot from conservative ideologues, like we have a lot of in this administration, about draining the swamp, right? And, you know, we've got to shift power away from inside the D.C. Beltway out to the field, out to the rural western communities where most of these public lands are. But in practice, Interior under Zinke is now run almost entirely by a small band of political operatives were very much based in D.C. One example is that this year Zinke proposed a massive agency-wide reorganization that was supposed to be designed to relocate decision-making out into the field, again, away from D.C. But you know, in coming up with this idea, he didn't consult his regional managers at all. He just met with them afterwards to seek input from experts, or so he said, on how to implement the plan, not on whether the plan was a good idea in the first place. And in fact, you know, the plan to reorganize the BLM is now under revision due to negative pushback from Western governors who, incidentally, were not consulted either.
Can you give our listeners some specifics about this? Like, hasn't Zinke issued directives to further an energy dominance agenda and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what you know, the sort of agenda that he's pushing, and that's being pushed throughout this administration. You know, he is about promoting energy dominance on our public lands, which is part of the multiple use mandate, but it's just one of them. And, you know, he's issued directives that actually make it difficult for local managers, so much for local decision making, right, to mitigate destructive effects that come from drilling and mining. So they're, you know, their hands are tied if they want to, you know, actually do something ecologically sensible to mitigate harmful side effects of these operations. And, you know, it is part of a pattern of Zinke taking unilateral actions that preempt local decision making. And some specific examples of that are that, you know, there was an Obama era directive for national parks to restrict sales of plastic bottles. So our national parks are drowning under solid waste, and much of it is plastic water bottles. And so there was this sort of progressive, helpful directive that national parks started implementing, but Zinke, you know, sent out a an edict that that parks needed to stop this, and you know we were gonna keep right up there with having these plastic bottles, but with no direction on what parks were supposed to do with these, you know, these massive amounts of solid waste. He's also directed mm-hmm. land managers actually to maximize public opportunities for things like target shooting, hunting, and fishing, while actually discouraging measures to protect wildlife, like common sense measures like limiting lead-based ammunition. He's even personally reversed quarantine requirements in Glacier National Park for motorized watercraft. These were instituted to slow the spread of invasive zebra mussels in park waters, but Zinke stepped right in and said, no, you can't do that. So, mm-hmm. you know, all these examples just show how averse Secretary Zinke is, despite the rhetoric, to actually deferring to his on-the-ground managers.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell, you brought this up a little bit when you were talking about Mike Ned, but can you tell our listeners about the acting directors of the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, and the Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yeah. Yeah, so the Trump administration has set records for the number of vacant positions throughout his administration at this stage in his term. So, and this is probably because it's difficult for Trump to find appointees that that fit his loyalty test who are credible enough to get through Senate confirmation. But so you know the upshot is that just in the Interior Department, the National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, which, as you know, are all major resource management agencies charged with managing millions of acres of public lands and all their, you know, wildlife resources and everything else on those public lands, all of these agencies are without permanent directors. All these agencies have acting directors, and as Pierre has spelled out in a recent lawsuit, they're therefore in violation of the Federal Vacancies Reform Act. So the Vacancies Reform Act was enacted in 1998 in the middle of the Monica Lewinsky fiasco, so at a, you know, it's a very contentious time between the president and Congress. But the mm-hmm. idea was to prevent a president from circumventing the Senate's power of advice and consent. So it was Congress's way of forbidding the president from bringing in outsiders as temporary leaders or just leaving temps in place for too long. So under the act, any action taken by an official who is not compliant, who has been appointed, you know, out of compliance with this act, shall, quote, have no force or effect, nor may that action be later ratified. So this means that every action these agencies have taken is vulnerable to court challenge under the Vacancies Reform Act. And as you know, these agencies handle a lot of very important issues with endangered species, drilling, mining, grazing.
Mm-hmm.
So we did file that complaint with the Interior's Office of Inspector General on these mm-hmm. acting directors. The office responded that the Interior Department actually has not been timely in filing reports on these acting positions, and that the complaint has been referred to the GAO. So what this tells us is that, that the actions, a lot of the actions that we've seen on endangered species and all sorts of issues by these acting directors may be vulnerable to legal challenge, and environmental groups are looking at this as one more tool to use mm-hmm. to challenge these actions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about PEER and Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington filing a lawsuit against Pruitt and the EPA over federal records law violations?
Yeah, so federal records law. So the federal records law basically says that that there have to be written records, there has to be documentation surrounding federal actions. So. Mm-hmm.
Like meetings
lots of evidence. The meetings, rule changes, decisions, all sorts of things. So so basically we've heard from lots of our contacts, especially within the EPA, is that Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, and other EPA political appointees have reportedly told EPA staff not to create, actually told them explicitly not to create a written record about anything of substance. So, and that includes, you know, major changes to policies that do affect our health and the environment. So we've heard specifically that Pruitt has prohibited staff from bringing cell phones into meetings, that he's directed staff not explicitly not to take notes, so there's no record. Of course, Pruitt is famous for his secrecy. He has a, you know, a fortified phone booth set up in his office. He uses phones other than his own to deal with important EPA matters, so the calls don't show up in his call logs, which are subject to FOIA.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, the Federal Records Act says that there has to be some sort of written documentation of what goes into agency decisions. So PEER and Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, filed a complaint that seeks to get Pruitt and the EPA to start maintaining records of essential actions in accordance with the Federal Records Act.
Well, good. Good.
Yeah.
And when did you guys file that? Not too long ago, right?
Yeah, that was
recently.
Yep, and you can see all these things on our website. The press releases are under news on our website, so you can see more.
Yeah.
You want to see these documents. So you know, since we work with whistleblowers or would-be whistleblowers inside the agencies, we often have the actual documents from the agency on which our press releases are based are always linked in those, so you can see that evidence right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just as an aside for some of our Wild Horse and Burro advocates, Wild Horse Freedom Federation filed a Freedom of Information Act request for emails from Lily Thomas, between Lily Thomas and the long-term holding contractors. Lily was the contracting officer's representative between Lily Thomas and the long-term holding contractors, and also between B. Wade and the long-term holding contractors, because B. Wade has done the environmental assessments or had done them for a very long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's kind of like, those two kind of helped run the show for a long time. Well, what we found out, Lily Thomas retired, and when I got, basically we asked for, I think, like a 10-year period or something, and what we got so few emails, and B. Wade said that they handled all of their business over the phone. But the interesting thing was we asked for all documents. So even if they had any notes of their phone conversations, that should have been provided. But none were provided. So basically they just said, oh, they do everything by phone. So again, this could be more widespread than anybody's aware of with our government agencies.
That's a really good example,
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about EPA's Superfund Task Force?
EPA's Superfund Task Force. So we heard about this task force from an EPA expert that we were in touch with, who basically told us that this task force was a farce, was a facade. And so basically what happened was that in May of last year, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt announced that he was taking personal control over all ongoing and future Superfund projects. And, of course, Superfund are contaminated industrial sites that are slated for remediation. So he announced this, and then he appointed a Superfund task force that he then said had developed a detailed plan to revamp the Superfund program. But once again, there was no paperwork, there were no meeting minutes, there was no supporting documentation surrounding the development of this program. There was just the announcement that this task force had over about a month produced a set of 42 recommendations for revamping Superfund with absolutely no documentation of where these recommendations came from, what they were based on, what science, what precedent, or any of that. So PEER submitted a FOIA request seeking basic information about this whole effort, like who was on this task force, you know, how did you pick them, what materials did they look at, and how did they arrive at decisions about, you know, overhauling Superfund. So by late August, the agency failed to produce any of the requested material, and so we filed a FOIA lawsuit to compel production, and the records we got back showed that there were 107 task force members, and they were all volunteers from EPA staff with no selection criteria. Meeting minutes were not kept.
Meeting minutes weren't kept?
No meeting minutes. No materials were presented to the Superfund Task Force. So they didn't look at anything in writing. And lo and behold, there was no, this is in quotes, there is no work product emanating from this task force.
Except for the final recommendations.
Except for the final recommendations. But nothing else, no evidence of where this stuff comes from, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from Pruitt's time as Oklahoma Attorney General, we know that he, has a history of coordinating with industry and actually using industry language in his petitions and legal filings. So we have a sneaking suspicion that this, you know, Superfund report was simply written by industry and then passed off to Pruitt's people to put it on EPA letterhead.
Yeah.
And call it a day.
Yeah, if you knew who was on the task force, but that's a lot of emails to try and get to find out about that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Didn't Peer also recently file a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to try to obtain the non-interference directives Pruitt claimed to have issued?
Yeah, so this was another, sort of similar issue. So last October, two EPA staff scientists and a contractor were scheduled to speak at a workshop on climate change in Providence, Rhode Island. But at the last minute, the EPA, higher-ups, political appointees at EPA stopped them from going. And so Democratic members of Congress demanded an explanation. And in December, Pruitt produced a letter to them that said, oh, I understand your concerns, and I'll put procedures in place right away to ensure that this won't happen again. And he also said that he was committed to upholding EPA's scientific integrity policy. But in his letter to Democratic members of Congress, he didn't specify what those procedures were, and he didn't say what he's done to uphold EPA's scientific integrity policy. So we filed a FOIA request in the lawsuit once again that sought to document what EPA actually has done to ensure that this doesn't happen again. So it's worth noting also that, you know, Pruitt can embrace EPA's scientific integrity policy all he wants. Actually, the policy is so weak, and it's worth noting that, the policy is from Obama's time, but nonetheless, it's a weak scientific integrity policy that doesn't have any specific procedures in place that let scientists know when they can speak or where they can publish. And so, you know, you can embrace the scientific integrity policy without actually committing to anything that amounts to anything for scientists. What's clear to us is that this lack of clear guidance on when and how EPA scientists can speak or publish acts as a soft gag. And so scientists are so, worried about the career consequences of speaking out on things that might be controversial, like climate change, that they're paralyzed. So
And then there's the all-out hard gag too they put on scientists, at least universities. So when EPA gives grants or whatever funding help to universities, universities do the hard gag. It seems
absolutely.
Or they only use industry writes their own papers, and the universities put those out, and then they and those are really bogus.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Could you, we're going to switch over here to another topic. Could you tell our listeners about the slaughter of wildlife by wildlife services?
Yeah. So sort of, circling back to the public lands issues, and, these will be of interest to a lot of the folks who are interested in wild horse issues, because, all of these, wildlife on our western public lands, on all of our lands, uphold the balance of nature. And this agency, this office, Wildlife Services, is really interfering with that balance. So it's an agency that was founded in about 1885, and it's gone through a few name changes, which were cosmetic but not really consequential. So until 1997, its name was Animal Damage Control. And its job is officially to mitigate and address human-wildlife conflicts. But unfortunately, it does this largely through using our tax dollars to kill wildlife. So in 2016, The office is responsible for destroying 2.7 million wild animals, largely because they were deemed a nuisance to ranchers or farmers in most cases, or sometimes to cities. Most of these animals are killed using poison. Widespread poison application, as you know, can have lots of unintended consequences, killing non-target species. You're trying to kill starlings that eat the grain used to feed cattle and feedlots, but you also end up killing owls, hawks, raccoons, domestic cats. A lot of these poisons place humans, children, domestic pets at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Other methods used by wildlife services include aerial gunning, so, you know, those helicopters chasing after coyotes, shooting them down, denning, traps. And it has huge impacts on, on the ecology of these native landscapes.
Denning. Tell our listeners what denning is?
Yeah, just, you know, going up to a den where wolf pups or bears might be in hibernation, or maybe they're just, you know, sleeping and gassing them out, just destroying the whole den. So you don't even know how many pups are killed because everyone in there is annihilated. So in 2016, Wildlife Services killed 385 gray wolves, 68,905 coyotes, 480 black bears, 2 bald eagles, also species that you wouldn't think of, like 21,559 beavers. Beavers are, you know, a keystone species, really important to creating these riparian ecosystems that are important for so many other creatures. Prairie dogs, the program killed 20,000 prairie dogs in 2016. This is targeting of prairie dogs is a big reason species like the black-footed ferret are nearly extinct, because prairie dogs are a main food source. So all sorts of unintended consequences. And once again, this is largely thanks to requests from the livestock industry. It amounts to $100 million a year subsidy for this small, highly politically influential industry that is directing mismanagement of our tax dollars to slaughter wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I read just in 2016 alone there were 2.7 million wild animals killed. And this has got to create, they're supposed to have a thriving natural ecological balance, at least the BLM is. Or if you're killing so many animals, of course it's going to have a domino effect and really,
absolutely
affect things. Can you tell us a little bit about Dr. Rob Wilgus? Is that how you pronounce his name?
His work
on the wolf livestock interactions at his large carnivore research laboratory at Washington State University.
So this is a really good example of how much political leverage the livestock industry has when it comes to directing wildlife management, directing approaches to wildlife management that are often not at all backed up by science. So Dr. Rob Wilgus is the director of the Large Carnivore Research Laboratory at Washington State University, and he pioneered a program that was funded by a state grant where ranchers could participate in efforts to avoid wolf-livestock conflicts through non-lethal means. So these means include using a guard dog or, herding livestock away from known occupied wolf dens or, removing cattle carcasses so that wolves don't eat them and become acclimated to beef, which makes them more likely to prey upon cows. And so Wilgus's work, it did end up finding that these non-lethal methods of avoiding conflicts were effective. In fact, they were more effective than the lethal methods. And ranchers who participated found less livestock depredations by wolves. So Dr. Wilgus, he wrote all this up in a report, and he also actually, while he was documenting his research findings, he also found that some ranchers declined to participate in his program, and not only that, but they actually deliberately sought to sabotage it by and to provoke conflict with wolves by placing salt licks close to a known wolf den. So sure enough, those wolves did end up preying upon cattle, who were attracted to the salt lick, and a state game agency responded by wiping out the entire pact because there's a, you know, a provision in state law for if, you know, if wolves prey on your livestock, you can have them killed, mm-hmm. with, again, with taxpayer funds.
mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Basically, wolf livestock depredations were kind of rare and acute, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it might be just certain situations, like when ranchers... So basically, when ranchers failed to follow the recommended techniques.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, that's what this research was all about. It's fairly easily avoided. You don't have to kill wolves. You can do simple things like herd your livestock away from wolves, clean up carcasses, and like you said, that, you know, livestock predations are going to be very rare if you do follow
mm-hmm.
these protocols.
Mm-hmm. And then,
yeah.
So after this, can you tell us about the political suppression of this research?
Yeah. So like I said, Dr. Wilgus, you know, he produced this report, and then he went to the press with his story and reported his findings, both about the positive results of his research and about what these renegade ranchers had done to sabotage it. And he actually
mm-hmm.
faced retribution from his administrators at his university. So he was threatened with disciplinary action. The administrators prohibited him from making further public statements to the press. They issued official statements that attacked his credibility. And they even imposed restrictions on his use of grant funds, so he couldn't be reimbursed anymore for research-related expenses.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, furthermore, his report attracted the attention of Republican legislators who were friendly with ranchers, and they made an effort to actually have him be silenced completely by the university. Fortunately, these
mm-hmm.
efforts were rebuffed, but at this stage, Pierre is getting ready to file a civil rights complaint against the university
oh,
that Dr. Will, that his academic freedoms were abridged, because they were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about the science of coyote control? Is there science to back up the lethal control of coyotes, or is this practice also politically motivated?
Yes. So once again, you know, coyotes are one of the most heavily targeted species by wildlife services, and the federal strategy for controlling coyote populations is to kill them, and that strategy is rooted in this one inaccurate and highly speculative 1975 study, which leads to the agency reportedly eradicating 76,859 coyotes in 2016 alone. So Pierre and a coalition of scientists and conservation groups filed a complaint against the USDA for using this 1975 study as the basis of this control strategy. So, and we filed the complaint under the Federal Data Quality Act, which requires that federal scientific work must be of the highest integrity, objectivity, and completeness. So this 1975 study, which is used to justify all the slaughter of coyotes, was never peer-reviewed. It's based on data that the authors of the study themselves concede were largely speculative. So they admitted that we don't really know how killing coyotes impacts their population. And, you know, it's becoming
mm-hmm.
more and more clear with much more recent research that actually coyotes are really good at adapting to difficult circumstances. They,
mm-hmm.
you know, they survive, they're built to survive, basically. So the more we target them, the more they their populations do well. And so much more recent literature suggests that non-lethal means of preventing coyote predation on livestock are much more effective. And also more recent research, tells us that coyotes are really important components of their ecosystem, and we need predators at the top of ecosystems to maintain the balance of nature once again. So
mm-hmm.
our lawsuit
mm-hmm.
demands that the USDA stop relying on this study and stop distributing it to state agencies. You know, what we want to happen is that our federal government stops using our taxpayer dollars to kill wildlife at the behest of interest groups.
Definitely.
And especially in light of the fact that, you know, it's becoming more and more evident that slaughter, that killing them is not the best way to control conflict. And there are much better ways of
mm-hmm.
doing it, as Dr. Wilgus and many others have showed us.
You've gotten a couple of questions. My producers Skyped me a couple of questions from listeners. Mm-hmm. One question is, are predators necessary? Without wolves, Isle Royale is at 7 moose per square mile.
Right. Well, sure, there's lots of research showing that when you lose those predators, you lose and all the prey species of those predators explode, and we have and vegetation can't withstand that. Riparian areas suffer. It really affects the entire web of life. Ecosystems evolve together and to create certain to create a balance, and when we start messing with that by killing off tens or hundreds of thousands of predators, we're going to see the consequences, and that's what we're seeing in a lot of these areas.
Yeah, and there was another question: how does deforestation, such as here in northern Minnesota, affect wildlife, and why are they doing it?
You know, I don't know the specifics of northern Minnesota, but forest fragmentation has a lot of impact on wildlife. Everything from Lyme disease here in the East Coast to, to impacting air quality. So, basically what we want to see is we want to see federal agencies' decisions on wildlife management to be based on science, not based on the political desires or the short-term self-interest of special interest groups. Like the livestock industry, like extractive industries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you give our listeners a brief overview of livestock grazing on public lands?
Yeah. So livestock grazing occurs on about 229 million acres of public lands, and most of those are in the western United States on Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service lands. So, and this is a system whereby private ranchers are using our public lands, which are supported by our taxes, to feed their privately owned livestock on public resources. And that those resources include the vegetation that has to be available to feed and provide habitat for wildlife. It includes the water resources that are, routinely as degraded and depleted by cows who drink, I've heard upwards of 20 gallons of water a day, which is a huge amount in some of these arid western states. These resources are used to sustain all the healthy ecosystems that we use for everything else that we use our public lands for, but they're, they're being sold off at a very cheap price to a small industry.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the fees ranchers pay to use our public lands?
Yeah, so ranchers do pay fees for the privilege of grazing on public lands, but the fees they pay are much lower than they would be on the open market. So last month, the BLM and the Forest Service decided to set federal grazing fees for 2018 at $1.41 per animal unit month, or AUM, for both agencies. So one AUM is equal to one cow and her calf, or one horse, or five sheep or goats that use federal public land. So this is a 25% decrease from 2017, when the fee was $1.87 per animal unit. And in 2016, actually, the rate was $2.11. So it's on a downward trajectory and getting worse all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing to remember about that, when the BLM, they always talk about the number of wild horses, but they always tell the public how many AUMs are for the cattle. And that's disguising, even if they did say, oh, we've got, 35 times more cattle than wild horses, that's just one animal. It's not a cow-calf pair. So when I look at BLM's grazing numbers, I always double that number because, it's usually double.
Right. It's a cow-calf, yeah.
There's a message here. They are diverting water at Leavenworth, Kansas, to the western states because of the massive overgrazing in the west, using up the water. The White River in Missouri has dropped more than 12 feet as a result. The White River and Osage area depend on the flow from Kansas to keep the river full.
Yeah, that's a really good point about the just the incredible water use of the livestock industry. You know, I used to live in New Mexico, and I don't know if this is still true, but at that time, alfalfa to feed cattle had overtaken green chili as New Mexico's number one export crop. And alfalfa is an incredibly water-intensive crop. You know, a lot of these western states, which are arid to begin with, 70% or more of the water supplies are going to livestock, whether that's to grow grain for livestock, alfalfa. You know, in a lot of these public lands, it's small ephemeral streams and riparian areas, which are just so important to local biodiversity, are almost completely diverted to fill upland stock tanks. And that's just an enormous impact that we don't think about on a large scale, but it's incredibly important to biodiversity and the integrity of these ecosystems throughout the West.
Yeah, and I know in when I was looking up water rights in Nevada, a lot of they call them irrigators, irrigators, but basically they're raising alfalfa for the cattle nearby.
Exactly.
And my producer just sent me a comment. 80% of all grain grown is fed to livestock.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yep. And a lot of it is for export, you know, and so we're using scarce water supplies in the western U.S. to export for cattle in Asia. I mean, it's the most irrational thing ever, but, you know, water restrictions
we're
on municipal users.
We're basically exporting our water, yeah.
Pretty much,
How are these fees a subsidy of the livestock industry?
Yeah, so, these grazing fees are just a fraction of what private land grazing fees are in comparable, places across western states. So the Department of Agriculture's National Agriculture Statistics Service tells us that comparable grazing fees would range from $9 per animal unit month in Arizona to $41 in Nebraska. And across the 16 western states, the average for private lands is $22.70. So it's just public land grazing fees just don't even come close to covering the enormous costs of operating this private industry on our public lands, and it's everything we've talked about. It's the damage to wildlife. It's the subsidized destruction of wildlife by wildlife services. It's the barbed wire fences. It's the stock tanks. All of this stuff is paid for by taxpayers, and of course there's damage to.
Yeah. I remember a long time ago, we were looking after this big fire in Northern California. Mm-hmm. They did a restoration project. And what that was building fences and really nice, kind of like with stone pillars for the fences to attach to. So they were probably even more extensive. They weren't just plain barbed wire fences. Mm-hmm. And it was right along the grazing allotment boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they were doing the seeding by the grazing allotments.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mm-hmm.
We saw a lot of that.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. No, western lands are crisscrossed by all these, by fencing and stuff. And you just wonder how much of that is totally paid for by tax dollars for the benefit of the ranching industry. A lot of it.
I think so too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little bit of perspective about how the livestock industry fits into the larger U.S. economy?
Yeah, so you'll hear a lot about how this is the pillar of rural economies, and but in reality, many public lands ranchers are actually just they're hobbyists, or in fact, in some cases they're corporations who actually derive most of their income from other sources. You know, one of my favorite public lands permittees, I don't think they still have a public lands permit, was Anheuser-Busch Corporation. So, you've got it's not at all the image of the archetypal, salt of the earth, many generations family rancher.
Yeah.
Right. That's not what it is. And, the fact is that beef is a declining food source for Americans over many years now. And even beyond that, from the beef that we do eat, that which is sourced from public lands cows is a very tiny percentage. And when you look at the benefits to rural economies of recreation, like activities like bird watching, hiking, whitewater rafting, or wildlife viewing, all these things are negatively impacted by the massive ecological damage wrought by cattle grazing. And And these economic benefits just far outweigh the tiny bit that Western communities get from public lands grazing.
Yeah, and I think Natalie was saying, you know, JBS Brazil has basically overtaken the beef industry here in the U.S. They own all but one of the stockyards, and they own and so many of the private ranchers. You know, they're corporate contractors, and JBS Brazil now is in possession of about 70% of all the processing plants, and it all happened under Bill Sack. Anyhow, can you tell our listeners a little bit about grazing trespass?
Yeah. So we've been talking about, you know, largely permitted grazing. So these, so most permittees have a permit for their grazing to graze in a certain place that, for a certain amount of time. But there's a lot of grazing that takes place that's actually not authorized. It's illegal. It's not covered by that permit that the rancher has. So there have been two reports by the Government Accountability Office. One was in 1990 and the other was in 2016. And both of them found that the BLM doesn't even know how much grazing trespass occurs across its land holdings. And in fact, it's made some commitments to start documenting, doing a better job of documenting it and even cracking down on it, but that it hasn't stuck by those commitments. So we sent a FOIA request to BLM for evidence showing that it had followed through on its latest pledges. So, the GAO issued these reports, and BLM said, okay, we're going to get right on that. You know, we're going to start keeping track of it. We're going to start cracking down on it. But the response we got back to our FOIA shows that the agency pretty quickly lost sight of these commitments, and then finally they just dropped off the radar altogether. They have no plan.
Oh, yeah,
now.
It's basically just lip service to the public. It's not that they're
really
exactly.
doing it. Exactly, and you know, the GAO reports confirmed. We've confirmed that the agency just prefers to to keep track of these things verbally. It's sort of a gentleman's agreement, like, you better round up those cattle, okay, right away. You know,
it's so much more helpful when you're turning a blind eye, not to have anything,
right?
Have a paper trail.
Exactly. Right. Right. So we have no idea how much grazing trespass is occurring. And we certainly have no idea whether the BLM plans to do anything about it. And it's really just another example of how the BLM is a captured agency, where those who are in charge of enforcing grazing regulations are very much a part of the whole culture of grazing. And it is a culture. And so they don't want to restrict the behavior of the cowboys that they actually feel a pretty strong affinity with.
Yeah. Well, especially, you know, when they live in these areas, they have families in these areas, their relatives are all, you know, it's
absolutely.
Just a ranching culture. And
it sure is.
Yeah,
yep.
But the public lands belong to all the American people, not
yep.
just a small segment.
Absolutely.
Do you think ranchers that graze their private livestock on public lands have a sense of entitlement?
Yeah, you know, you do. You sort of hear them talk, or you do. There's sort of this idea that among ranching apologists or supporters that you know, government welfare is a bad thing, and welfare recipients are urban dwellers who are failures, and they're, you know, they have nothing in common with hardworking, self-reliant ranchers who are kind of, you know, the salt of the earth, and they live out there in the rural West. And yet, you know, there's never any examination of the fact that this is an enormous welfare program. This is a system of subsidies that benefit one very specific industry in the form of heavily subsidized grazing fees, services like the barbed wire fencing, the predator control, and the changes to our hydrology, to our water systems that impact, wildlife, recreation, and all of these resources that we hold in common.
How do you think working on with PEER and everything you do, how's it affected you personally, do you think?
Well, I've worked on public lands, sort of extractive industry issues, especially grazing, for a long time, and You'd always sort of hear through the grapevine about people within the agencies who did care and who did want to uphold those agency missions and who did,
uh-huh.
you know, agree with the majority of Americans that conservation of wildlife and conservation of recreation opportunities and clean water and native ecosystems is important and is sort of the fundamental purpose of these agencies. And so I was, you know, I was intrigued by the idea that, that these people, these agency employees were a resource that could be tapped, that they both needed support from a group like peer, legal support, other forms of support, and that they could be a powerful vehicle for change in themselves. And that's, you know, that's what we find, is that there's a lot of, you know, sort of sad and disheartening stories, for example, of what it's like to work in the EPA under Scott Pruitt, but there are also some really empowering stories of what change is possible with the help of the Freedom of Information Act and the help of, you know, a legal team that sort of understands the legal hooks that can be used to hold these agencies accountable. So, you know, it is empowering, especially at a time like this, to work somewhere that is sort of committed to tapping on the good that still exists, exists throughout public service.
Yeah, and to me, like, you know, Wild Horse Freedom Federation has filed many FOIA requests, and it's just, you know, how else do we understand how and if the government is operating in the way they say, or what they're planning? You know, they might like graze over their plans a little bit in public meetings, but it's not until you actually review a lot of emails or notes that you really find out what's going on. You know, and people, just so you know, you can file a Freedom of Information Act for government employees. Emails, any notes of meetings. Yeah, they may not have taken any, but, you know, you can try.
Right.
but it's a long process, basically, and finding, you know, and that's another issue that you know, it seems to take longer and longer to get Freedom of Information Act request information.
Well,
you know, you try and get it for people, but...
Right. Well, that's how we end up filing the FOIA lawsuits, and we always win those because, you know, they have to produce the documents.
Yeah.
You know, they have to produce these documents, and they usually refuse within the allotted time frame, and then we sue, and we get them. So,
and then when they've got a judge looking at what they're doing, and they have to fork over some,
Exactly.
Can you tell me, but, you know, PEER covers so many different issues. I mean, you know, I really spent a lot of time looking at your website, and actually I'm going to share an article tomorrow, one of the PEER articles, but one of the things that was on there was about our national risk assessment, America's strategic national risk assessment. Can you tell everybody a little bit about that?
Yeah. So this is sort of
interesting
thing.
It's missing in action, basically.
Right. Yeah. Who the heck knows where it is? In 2011, President Obama directed the creation of a national preparedness program, which would feature a strategic national risk assessment. And this is should have been an assessment of all the risks we face that you can imagine, from, you know, failing infrastructure to terrorism, like extreme weather events, everything. So, and it's obviously intended to inform, to make us prepared for any of these risks. So there was a draft that was completed in 2015, but it never saw the light of day. And it's likely, we're pretty sure, that it discussed climate change and the risks that that are posed by climate change, and so that led to its political suppression. And by the way, there was a fair amount of political suppression of information related to climate change even during the Obama administration, and there's plenty of information on that in on our website. So we filed a FOIA request for the 2015 assessment report, and when we got no response, we filed a FOIA lawsuit against the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which responded, "Oh, that report is not in our purview." But FEMA actually has a web page dedicated to this risk assessment. So, So they told us, that's not in our purview. You better go ask the National Protection and Programs Directorate, or NPPD. So we followed up with them, and they said, oh, no, your request belongs to FEMA, not NPPD. So so basically these agencies are playing hot potato with a required analysis that is really essential to guide our preparedness. And, you know, it should be out in the public sphere in the hands of emergency managers rather than hidden away. Before we're, you know, where we can't even get it through FOIA.
We have a little few extra minutes, so I just wanted to bring one issue up that in April of 2017, Ryan Zinke diverted a National Park Service boat to pick him and his family members up for a 3-hour tour. And to go to, like, just stop by a junior ranger swearing-in ceremony. So the NPS boat, and this was on the PIR website, the NPS boat left Ventura, California port to travel to Santa Barbara Harbor to pick up Zinke and his wife and aunt and take them and other members of his party to Santa Rosa Island, part of the Channel Islands National Park, and back that same day. Well, the party spent more time at sea than on the island, with a 3-hour itinerary that consisted of photo ops, a tour, lunch, and Zinke swearing in middle school students as junior rangers. But the government ship cost taxpayers around $4,000, including fuel and crew overtime. But the thing is, Zinke, who brought along two local fishermen who he classified as technical experts, although on what issue is unclear, but Zinke only had to fork over, they only gave Zinke a bill for $142, because he didn't pay it in time, it increased to $152. So anyhow, it's just one more thing about the Zinkes.
It's sort of a pattern. You can look at the attachments to that press release, Zinke commandeered boat for Channel Islands jaunt. You can find that on our website. And the attachments are I was looking at those, and they're actually kind of amusing, just how these technical, so-called technical experts are classified. So you can take a look at that on our website and maybe have a laugh at Zinke's expense.
Kristen, we're almost at the end of our show. We've got about 3 minutes. My producer's been sending me messages that there are a lot of requests for you to come back on the show another time.
So maybe next
time you come back on, we could actually have people calling in with questions of their own to ask you. I didn't have questions tonight because there was, you know, you guys are doing so much work. I wanted to quickly get through as much as I could just so people would know more about what's going on. But we'd love to have you back again sometime.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell everybody about, anything that's coming up
Just, you know, if there are any public employees who have environmental jobs or work for environmental agencies, who, you know, among your listeners, we just want to let you know that we exist to serve your needs. So we're a service organization. You know, we offer free and confidential legal and other support for public employees who are trying to do the right thing in their agencies. And, you know, you don't have the thing that we emphasize, that you don't have to be a whistleblower. You know, whistleblowers risk their careers, and, you know, we really admire them and we support them too. But through the Freedom of Information Act, you can usually find a way to get the information into the public sector without risking your career. And that's sort of a subspecialty of PIRs, is helping employees become anonymous activists. So using the Freedom of Information Act to get that information out without actually jeopardizing your career. And that's one of the main ways that we serve employees and serve the public by holding these agencies accountable.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've only got a couple minutes left, Kristen, so I wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to be on our show. I hope you guys keep up all the excellent work you're doing.
Okay.
And I want to tell our listeners to learn more about the many issues covered by PIR. Go to their website at PIR.org. You can find out what they do. You can take it. They have a Take Action tab. You can also sign up to get their quarterly newsletter called PIR Review. I'd like to thank our producer, Marty Oakley, and let everyone know that on Thursday nights, Marty hosts a show called Whistleblowers. You'll have to listen to that sometime.
definitely.
So thanks.
So thanks, Marty. And I'd also like to thank all of our listeners for joining us tonight. Be sure and listen to our show next week. Our guest will be Stephanie Say, the media coordinator for the Buffalo Field Campaign, letting us know about what's happening with the buffalo in Yellowstone, very similar to what's happening to our wild horses and burros. So thanks again, Kirsten. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Debbie.
Okay, good night.
Good night.